Hello, PC Gamer Podcast listener, Tom here. Unfortunately, I need to give this episode a little bit of a disclaimer. We had a lot of audio issues this episode, both in recording them, and then also we had to make a couple stops during the live show because a mixer board was having trouble, and then mics weren't working, and it was just a whole debacle. And sadly, what that means for you guys is that the audio is very inconsistent this episode. The very beginning of the episode, for about 15 minutes at the start, some people are very, very loud, others are very, very quiet. And we did our best to try to fix some of that. And then for another 5 or 10 minute section in the middle there, it will sound kind of like we were recording in like a garage or something. It's very tinny and echoey and a lot of background noise being picked up. And then we got it figured out. We put one mic down and it was a much simpler experience, and it'll be a lot nicer to listen to about halfway through the episode. But that does mean that the episode ran short because of that. It also means we had to cut this week's Cat Fantastic quiz, which is a big bummer, but it'll be back next week. Thank you very much for listening anyway. We'll be back next week again with Cat Fantastic and our regular high-quality audio setup. But yeah, we'll see you then and enjoy the show. Everybody, and welcome to the PC Gamer Show. My name is Tom Marks, assistant editor here at PC Gamer, and we have some very special guests with us today. First of all, our Wes Fenlon, our hardware editor here at PC Gamer. Yes, you are the special guest. No, our special guests today are Paul Nurath, CEO and founder of Other Side Entertainment and one of the co-founders of Looking Glass Studios back in the day. How you doing, Paul? Welcome to the show. And then, of course, Joe Fielder, I can't remember your title now.
Design director,
excuse me. That's totally my fault. Joe, how are you?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Good, good. Welcome to the show, guys. They're here to tell us about Other Side's kickstarted game, Underworld Ascendant, which we're going to get a first look at some of the latest build, which you basically haven't shown since the Kickstarter was your very, very early build. Mm-hmm. Then we'll also be talking about stealth games, because we can't not talk about stealth games when we have one of the creative directors of Thief with us. We'll be talking about the newly announced Far Cry Primal. We have our regular Cat Fantastic quiz, which is an audio quiz this time. And then we'll be talking about CRPGs, and then RPGs in general, leading into Undertale being ridiculously highly rated on Metacritic right now, which I'm excited about all of those things. But let's start off with our regular Now Playing, where we talk about whatever we're playing or excited about right now in games. Wes, what have you been playing lately?
First, take a breath, Tom.
Yeah, I know. We had some, for those at the podcast, we had some technical difficulties, so I was trying to jump through the intro if I could.
So I've been on the show like about every 3 weeks or so. In the past, I think two times I was on, I was still playing The Witcher 3.
Yeah.
It took me like 4 months to finish The Witcher 3 and ended up playing like 80-something, 85 hours into that game, but I finally finished it. And thought about jumping straight into Metal Gear, and I just couldn't. I didn't have the heart for another like 50-plus hour open world, crazy expansive game. So I actually have been playing a lot of 80 Days the past week, which is this wonderful iPhone game that just got ported to PC and Mac, and it's basically an interactive novel. It's like a visual novel type thing where you're. It follows the story of Around the World in 80 Days. So you're traveling around the world, trying to complete an entire quest in kind of 80 turns. And the setting is this amazing, like, late 1800s sci-fi steampunk interpretation of Jules Verne's kind of world. So it's much more expansive than the novel is, even just in terms of the amount of character it has. So you're riding on these, like, automata horse carriages and flying in airships and, you know, crazy steam vessels. And it has just like this really rich appreciation for different world cultures. And so you'll meet the Mongols and you'll meet like Native Americans in America. You'll go to Atlantis. You'll go through Africa, depending on what routes you take. And like all these just interesting little stories that are woven together that I don't know how they wrote this game, because there's just so much text in it. It's 100% text, and there's like 100 different paths you can take around the world. So I've been playing a few loops of that the last couple days, and it's really, really fun.
Cool.
Love it. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was a game that you and I think it was Evan were excited about when you heard it was coming to PC, right? Because it was
I played it on mobile. I played it on my phone last year for about – it was like one day over the holiday break. I downloaded it because I'd heard a lot of good things, and I ended up just playing it all day, which is pretty rare for me to go from barely knowing what something is to then just – I just like sat in bed the day after Christmas and just played that game for like 12 hours straight.
Yeah.
And just went around the world like five times. So I was, when I heard that it was coming to PC, I wasn't like, oh, good, now I can play this, this text game on a PC. This is exciting. I was excited because they added like another 150,000 words or so of plot to the story and a bunch of new paths. So I was excited for that part.
Cool.
But it's really good on PC. Like the interface is very simple. It's pretty much just mouse click to kind of go through text. But it works well. Like it's very pretty and it's just easy to sit on your laptop and just kind of read. So
cool.
That's what I've been playing.
Cool. And Joe, what about you? I imagine both of you have been playing Underworld Ascendant some, but
quite a bit.
have you been able to jump out of that? Have you been playing any other games at the same time?
Yeah, I've been. I snuck in a little bit of New Game Plus on Witcher 3, and Metal Gear Solid 5 has basically replaced my sleep cycle. on the flight out here, I was playing Legend of Grimrock on the iPad, which was pretty neat as well.
Is that Grimrock 1 or Grimrock 2?
Grimrock 1.
It's 1, okay.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
They haven't put 2 out on iPad yet, have they?
I haven't seen it. And 1 transfers over really nicely. It's actually a little easier to keep track of everything. Hmm. You can the touch-based controls. You can react a little faster, and so it's pretty neat.
Very cool. And so you said you were playing Metal Gear out of curiosity. Have you done any of the FOB missions or anything like that?
I have not. I've been doing an inordinate amount of base building, but
okay.
not any of the FOB missions yet.
Yeah. Our intern, James, has just been basically spending the last 2 weeks in like FOB hell. Like
we made him.
Yeah, we made him do this. it was... He sounded like a little painful. He was telling me also that speaking of base building, that building one platform for the FOB stuff and not even like the highest tier platform takes something like 8 hours of in-game time now. There might be a tier higher than that that I'm not aware of, and that's 8 hours. Like the clock doesn't run when you're not playing. Like it's you have to say you want to build this, and then 8 hours of gameplay later, you get something in the game, which seems kind of hilarious to me, but
They also just Konami just announced yesterday that they are instituting a new FOB insurance system. So if you're not familiar with FOB, you basically have resources put into this your forward operating base, and then people can come invade it and take your resources. And you can do the same to other people's bases, but this can happen even when you're not online.
Yeah.
So now they're going to sell as a microtransaction insurance. So that you can lock down your base, I think, so that nobody can come and steal your stuff while you're offline.
Just so they don't steal my dog, I'll be happy.
Yeah. I love the idea of spending real world money to protect like fake assets, right? Like that's such a funny idea.
I don't love that idea at all, Tom.
Okay, maybe love was a strong word. What about you, Paul? What have you been playing?
Occupational hazard, working on a game that I don't have enough time to play a game.
Gotcha.
But I have tried The Witcher 3, Bloodborne, on the mobile side, playing some Fallout Shelter, which I've been fun with that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, then let's move right along and let's start talking about stealth games in general. Like, the idea was, what makes a good stealth game? What makes a bad stealth game for a while? One of the things that has been a point of contention lately was there were reports that Assassin's Creed, the latest Assassin's Creed, adds now an invisibility, a way to turn completely invisible. And Metal Gear Solid actually has that as well, but it's a much less... you get it way, way late in the game. So I guess that's my first question is, like, how do you guys feel about, like, is invisibility, like, cheating in a stealth game? Or does that, like... I guess remove the point of being stealthy, like to a certain degree, or I don't know. Like, would you have ever put invisibility?
No,
did that ever cross your mind?
I don't know. We never thought about putting invisibility in. I mean, stealth is an interesting gameplay mode because it requires you to think about how you deploy it and how you tactically use it as you're moving through the space.
Yeah.
And so if you're just literally invisible, then there's not much thinking about it, then you just go and do whatever you want. So, you know, we for stealth to be interesting, you have to feel vulnerable, and you have to feel like, well, if I don't use my techniques and I use them effectively, then, you know, I could get into trouble pretty quickly. And in the Thief games, Thief 1 and 2, you know, you weren't a very good fighter. And so while you could fight, you know, you would easily get overmatched, particularly if there was more than a couple of opponents came at you at once.
Yeah.
And that was a very intentional to push you into saying, hey, you really have to use your stealth skills. So, yeah, I don't think we would ever put invisibility in the
feed. Just to interrupt real quick, we're getting a couple requests in the chat. Just have everybody speak a little closer to the mics than, sure. than before.
Get sure. up on it.
Yeah, just get up on it a little bit.
So if you maybe this is something you actually did explicitly for Thief when you were working on it, but like, what are like the 10 commandments of a stealth game? You're like, what do you set down?
10
as,
of them? I don't know.
Or what are the, you know, the 4 commandments or whatever of designing what you think of as a great stealth game?
Well, for Thief, we put stealth as the lens that all the game decisions were made. So we sort of committed to stealth, and so that's sort of commandment number one, that if you're going to do a game that's based around stealth, that all the other design decisions sort of fall out of that. The other elements is that the world has to respond to your stealth. So there's a lot of burden on the, you know, the artificial intelligence and the behaviors of mm-hmm. the guards and the opponents to react to your stealthiness. And without seeing that reaction, one of the things that we sort of discovered about halfway through is that it was very important for the guards to telegraph to you their sense of your stealthness, because the stealth is a quality that only exists between, you know, you and an opponent, right? If you're stealthy and you're alone, it's sort of pointless. So we had to create a feedback, and it's not the typical feedback that you think of in a game of how do you tell the player, whether someone is searching for them, how aware they are, what their sense of presence is. So we created this sort of chatter system that we actually came out of doing a golf game, British Open Golf, we were working on. We had color commentary done dynamically. We adopted some of that technology over. Yeah,
pretty comparable, right?
There's some similarities, you know, but stealthy on a golf course. But the so the guards would, for instance, if you made a little bit of noise that sounded out of place, a guard might say, you know, what's that? Mm-hmm. That's odd. So they got a sense that maybe there's something amiss. And they'd speak aloud their suspicions, and they'd go into search mode and look around. If after, you know, 5 or 10 seconds you were silent, they didn't hear anything more, they typically ratchet back down and say, oh, it must have just been a rat or whatever. And so those are telegraphing their awareness of your stealth and what you're doing, which was a very important aspect of that. So I think, I don't know if that's a cardinal rule or not, but mm-hmm. it's important as a player to understand how your stealth was impacting with the world. The other thing that was for Thief very important is to give the player tools to modify the environment, the world around them, to take advantage of the stealth. So the world wasn't just static, it wasn't dry. If I walk quietly, that's all I have to do, or if I stay in the shadows. So the water arrows were, you know, a good illustration of that kind of a tool, where you could be in a corridor that had a series of torches that was well lit, and, you know, knowing that if you try to just traverse that with the light, you'd probably be seen. So, you know, you think ahead of time, and you say, let me knock out the torches with my water arrow, create a corridor of darkness, and I can move through it. So that ability to sort of give and take with the environment, and the player to be able to change the environment, really made stealth much more interesting.
And that's something, a lot of what you're talking about, similarly, since you brought up Metal Gear, Joe, is like, I feel like when I was playing that game, a lot of it was learning the limits of how the guards could see you and when they would see you and like how you could interact with your environment. And it's interesting because one of the faults of where stealth goes wrong in that game is that once you learn your limits, you learn that your limits are much lower than you originally thought they were, and you can get away with a lot more than you thought you could. Mm-hmm. And then the game becomes a little bit easier because you've learned like, oh, this guard won't react the way I thought he would or something like that. And I think that's a key part of making, like you said, a really compelling stealth game is like making push, like having those limits be a pro, like you'll get limited by them, as the name would imply of limits, but like you'll get it'll prevent you from doing what you want to do, but not to an unachievable degree. It seems like a very, very hard, like a very fine line to walk.
I think they do something pretty interesting and fun for Metal Gear Solid 5 is that if you get up pretty close to one of the guards, they'll do the slow-mo where you have a few moments to,
right,
you know, knock somebody out or whatnot. And that gives you it's a little bit of give. It makes it fun. You can kind of game it a little bit. But they also, you get a bonus if you never have those things happen at all. So if you just totally sneak up on everyone without ever triggering any of those, then they reward you for that. So
yeah.
I think that's kind of a fun give and take with that.
Yeah, to S rank, don't you have to be pretty much like perfectly stealthy?
Yeah.
But then also the perfectly stealthy sometimes gets, in that game, gets lost for the quickness, where like I know that the speed run of Ground Zeroes, the prequel to Metal Gear Solid 5 Phantom Pain, I think the speedrun of that game is like 3 minutes, and it's literally because they just sprint to a destination, and the reflex mode, that slow-mo, kicks in, and they headshot the guy, and then they keep running, and then they headshot the next guy in slow-mo, and they keep running, and like, that's what I kind of meant of like, the limits of what the guards will react to is lower than you originally think it is, because when you're first going through that game, you're like trying not to be seen at all, and like, there's actually a viable strategy, you're just getting seen by everyone.
I think one of the big challenges to me looking at stealth games just as a player, not a designer, has been finding the limits of the ambiguity that you experience, especially in three-dimensional games where when you walk up to a guard, you know their vision isn't infinite. And in a lot of cases, especially older stealth games, you could stand, you know, 15 feet away from a guard and they would be looking kind of in your direction, but you're just outside of that like cone of vision that... You know, and in your head, you're like, in reality, this person would clearly be able to see me, but in the game, I know that their limit is, you know, some smaller degree, and that kind of breaks the immersion, and it makes it a little bit harder to kind of buy into, like, feeling stealthy when you're like, well, I can just walk in front of this guy as long as I'm far enough away. One game that I thought was really interesting in the way it subverted that was Mark of the Ninja, which was a 2D game that Clay Entertainment made that came out a few years ago. Have you played it?
A fantastic game.
Yeah, I thought it was the way they made every element of stealth explicit in the game was really interesting. Like, every guard would have their, like, you know, their vision cone, like, just circle around them and the degree to which they would hear audio and stuff like that. And at any point that you crossed that, you know, that circle, they would see you or they would hear you explicitly, and anything outside that, they wouldn't. And it seemed like it would make it too easy or something, but it let them design very difficult scenarios and specific scenarios and gave you lots of tools for working around that, and you would just know exactly what you could and couldn't pull off in those situations.
Three Commandos took a similar approach to
it. Did it? Okay.
But it's sort of more wargamey, board gamey approach to it, so it worked well. That was a top-down game. Or essentially isometric top-down game. And it was the same thing. It was all about timing and visibility and watching cones of vision go back and forth. It's a different approach, but it works too.
I think we actually really quickly need to take a brief break in the stream just to fix these audio problems one more time. Once again, sorry everybody that we're just going to cut the stream for a short amount of time, and then we'll be back very soon. So don't go anywhere, and we'll keep talking about stealth games. Hey everybody, welcome back. Sorry about that extended break. We had some technical difficulties that you saw the people below us scurrying around trying to figure out. Apologies again to our guests as well, but thank you for sticking through and for watching, and thank you for the sub 12GTU.com or 12GTCom, I said that terribly, for subbing during that break and all the technical difficulties. So let's get back into it, though. Let's jump right back into talking about stealth. I think one of the things you guys brought up right before we broke off was, like, the idea of, like, the zones, right? And, like,
making stealth kind of vision and audio and that kind of those elements very explicit, as opposed to being more nebulous as they are in a lot of 3D stealth games. Yeah.
Right, and if we go back to just talking about, I hate to beat the Metal Gear horse, but it is on my mind lately.
The Diamond Horse?
Yes, the Metal Gear Diamond Horse. The idea of, like, that game doesn't have any stealth cones compared to a game where it's like you can see the UI in front of the guard, like very, very, as you said, explicitly. Like, I kind of like that way of doing it. I like the unambiguous stealth cone way. It of course will break immersion in a lot of games that are supposed to be like hyper realistic, right? But I don't know. I just, there's some part of me where it feels more like a, like, maybe this is bad to some people, but it feels more like a game to me when I can see that object that I'm supposed to be avoiding. I don't know. Did you, like, what's your opinion on that then?
I think it depends on the kind of game you're making. If you're making a game that's more of a kind of a war gamey, tactical strategy game, I think it can really help. In a game like Thief, where it's supposed to be immersive, and your character, you're playing the Thief character, you're supposed to be using, you know, your skills as a player and learning your skills without sort of the abstraction of it being a game with all these sight lines being rendered. So I don't think it works very well for Thief.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But at the same time, you still have like a light meter and aspects like that. So it's a real
the light gem was our UI, you know, the one UI thing that we gave.
Your one concession.
The one concession. But it is a magical gem, so it fits in your hand.
I think also with, as games get more advanced and AI in particular gets more advanced, you can do more on that, on the immersive side, and kind of, you have fewer instances where the player is going to lose immersion because, you know, a character does something really stupid when you walk 10 feet in front of them and they don't see you. You know, we see less and less of that, I think, in stealth games. Are there any recent stealth games the last 5-10 years that you've played that you thought did stealth really well?
Well, I thought Dishonored did some interesting things with stealth. I tried to play Dishonored as a stealthy character. What I found was that it could be a pretty challenging game, and there were situations where there were a lot of guards that I couldn't get through very easily, and I just didn't have time to like replay it 3 or 4 times a scenario, so I just whip out my sword and kill everybody. And soon I find myself falling back on fighting. You become a very powerful fighter in that game pretty easily. So I ended up with a dark and rainy all the time.
Yeah, I was a total chaos in Dishonored and all the DLC as well.
Right. Yeah.
But I wanted to play.
Well, that brings up another thing of, like, I guess, like, do stealth games that are, like, there's always that problem of the boss fights in stealth games, right? Like
Deus Ex Human Revolution had that problem where the stealth was really, really, really good throughout that game, and then it would throw you into an arena with a boss, and like the only way to get through those fights that was really fun was to just like use your overpowered like arm cannon and just kind of nuke them in 1 or 2 hits and just get through the fight.
I must suggest that breaks sort of a first cardinal rule. Is if a game is about stealth, you don't want to have any gameplay that really breaks if you're trying to use stealth.
Yeah,
that was one of your commandments. Yeah,
if you're doing a game that's all about stealth.
Sure.
And speaking of stealth, our audio team is going to stealth in here just for a half second longer to set up what looks like a very large boom mic. Hey everybody, welcome back once again.
Again.
We figured it out. We are going with our lovely Blue Yeti Pro here, so thanks to Blue for sending that to us, I guess, a while back.
We figured out the solution was get rid of all the really expensive equipment and just use one mic.
That's where the failure was we spent too much money, I think. So we were on stealth boss fights, and the idea that boss fights in stealth games would sometimes, like in Deus Ex, force you, not the original
in
Deus Ex.
Human Revolution.
Human Revolution would sometimes force you into basically combat situations in a stealth game. And I think they said that the new Deus Ex, they want to try to avoid that. And then there was another game that I can't remember. I think it was Dishonored, actually, that would also, you mentioned, was a similar situation of, like, you have to just, like, shoot them with your wrist cannon, basically, and that was the easiest way to do it. Like, I guess the question I have is, like, is it ever actually possible to have a stealth game that, like, or a game that gives you a choice of play style where every boss fight, like, scenario feels equally rewarding, you know? Like, because I feel like the way you win boss fights stealth is, like, just sneak by them or, like, drop things on their head secretly. And it feels like no matter how you design it, unless all the boss fights are, like, very similar, there's always going to be some that are just, like, not, like, some ways to do it that just aren't fun, like, fundamentally. Like, maybe I'm wrong about that. I've never played the new Human Revolution or Human Revolution, so I'm not sure.
I think it probably depends a lot on the type of player you are, what you get satisfaction from. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure designing to make every possible option for a game that gives you different options equally satisfying is and quite a difficult proposition.
Yeah. So I think we have talked about stealth for what feels like a while, although maybe that's only been a combined few minutes.
Feels like it's been half an hour, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the next item on our list, which is Far Cry Primal. Got announced officially today, accidentally yesterday.
IGN Turkey.
Yeah, for that that little leak. But I'm going to pull up the trailer real quick just to play in the background with no audio. Basically, for those of you who haven't seen it, it looks like what it's shaping up to be is a primordial, caveman-ish themed, like tribal-themed expansion to Far Cry in the same way that, or expansion-ish thing to Far Cry 4 in the same way that Blood Dragon was to Far Cry 3. Mm-hmm. Is that right? And so it's like not necessarily a full game on its own, like more of like a large spinoff. But it's interesting because they're not going to have any guns and they're not going to have any cars, which seem to be like those are pretty, like when I'm thinking of Far Cry, those seem like pretty
fundamental sure,
pieces
yeah.
of those games. And we haven't seen much of it yet. I am disappointed because I'm pretty sure there's not dinosaurs in it. And I wanted dinosaurs in a Far Cry game real bad, but that's okay.
There are woolly mammoths, so...
Yeah, this is a constellation prize.
Yeah, the woolly mammoths.
Some saber-toothed cats, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. But, so, is like, dinosaur-ish and, like, old school, is that the new, like, future warfare? Mm-hmm. Like, is that what we're doing now? Like, there was a period where everyone was just going to the future in space, and now we're, like, going thousands of years in the past, I guess. Like,
well, I think you can bear down on survival and have pretty a lot of fun with it. I think it might... You know, for me, like, hearing no cars isn't, like, a red flag, because, you know, playing, say, The Long Dark, which is mm-hmm. being developed by some folks who worked on the Far Cry series,
yeah.
the moment-to-moment of that, it's really, like, you're hand-to-mouth, and it's a really, really fun indie title.
Yeah, yeah, no, and that's another, you know, obviously not mammoths in that, but it's a similar, like, exploring the wilderness mm-hmm. sort of vibe to it. I guess that is a good question, is does the Far Cry formula need cars and guns?
I think Far Cry, I'm happy to see it kind of get stripped back a bit, and maybe in more ways than one. You know, Far Cry has definitely fit into Ubisoft's, their kind of style of game, where you have this big open world, you've got a million things on your mini-map to go check out, and you have to skin 30 different types of animals to make, you know, pants and holsters and stuff out of them. And that loop is fun and rewarding, and I'm sure there will be lots of hunting in this game. But setting it in, you know, the time period they're setting it in also gives them the opportunity to do more with those mechanics, like make hunting a more important mechanic than it is in Far Cry 3 or Far Cry 4. So I think that's potentially really cool.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, I guess for you, like, what is a... For Paul, like, does... What's the word? Primordial, I guess. Is that, like, old caveman-y style? Like, does that appeal to you as, like, it's from a design space? Like, at all, or...?
Sure, it could be interesting. I mean, I think it's worth exploring these different kind of milieus and spaces and seeing what you can extract from them. And a primordial setting obviously distills it down to the more basics of survival, as Joe was saying. And I think if you go deep on that, it could be interesting.
Yeah. So.
Are there any settings for games recently that you've found exciting in particular? Be it time periods or kind of just the style of the world?
I don't gravitate to a time period or style so much. I look at the gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
So and if the gameplay fits the style, whatever that style is, then that's great. And it's good to see that. But I don't go out thinking, well, I want a I want to find a cyberpunk game, or I want to find a Victorian era game, per se.
I do. I'm like, I want a cyberpunk game. The Witcher devs, CD Projekt, was just talking today about how they're like, cyberpunk's going to be so much bigger than The Witcher 3. And like, part of me is like, yay, and then the other part is like, I can't handle that. Like, The Witcher 3 is so big already that I hope big for cyberpunk just means like depth, not, you know, not breadth.
Are some games getting too big, do you think, today?
I think absolutely some games are, yeah.
I mean, we were just having the conversation recently on the show about, like, are there games that are too small, right? Like, because of, like, Steam's refund policy, and that is the other side of it, is, mm-hmm. like, I mean, I got 30 hours into Metal Gear, and then I stopped playing it, because, and I don't feel like I've missed out on that game, it's just, but, like, I was also only 20% through it, you know, in 30 hours, like... There's this rise, and I wanted to talk about this a little later too, of these like huge, insanely expansive, insanely time consuming open world experiences that like have kind of become the AAA standard to a certain degree, right? Like that's just what's expected of AAA games now. When you get Mad Max and you see like Shadow of Mordor from the same company, and Metal Gear was like this, and all of the Assassin's Creeds are like this, and Far Cry, I'm sure Far Cry Primal is going to be this huge open world you could spend 100 hours in, you know? Like, I don't know. I think maybe games are getting a little too long, but...
It all depends on what you're doing with that time, right? Does it feel bloated? Are there lots of little objectives thrown in that are actually kind of repetitive and that you're not going to want to do 150 times? You know, like The Witcher 3 has tons of little stuff out in the world that you can, monster nests you can destroy, and yeah, you could spend 200 hours blowing up every one of those if you want. You're going to get bored. Mm-hmm. The reason I don't think The Witcher 3 is too big of a game is because so many of the quests are supported by, like, genuinely interesting narrative. Like, good writing, interesting characters, something funny or weird, unique happening in the world that absolutely kept me engaged for the 80 hours that I played it. And maybe if I'd played it for 200, I would have gotten weary of that stuff. But, you know, you just have to have the substance there to back it up, I think.
Yeah. And there's a bit of that, like, the idea of, like, making somebody retread their own footsteps. Mm-hmm. Like, well, let's talk about how big of a game do you imagine Underworld Ascendant is going to be? Do you guys see that as like a 100-hour epic or like...
No, we're an indie studio, and so we're not trying to create a massive game.
Right.
And we really wanted... The focus is on more on replay. We'd rather have people go through the game, say, as a thiefly character and experience it that way, and then say, let me try it again as a fighter. And then have a very different experience.
Right.
Part of our goal is if you had two different players who play through the game, and then they'd say, hey, they share their experiences and say, you played a different game than I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that to me is kind of more interesting than creating a massive amount of content that you have to sort of plow through over 100 or 400 hours.
Yeah, we have a few elements in the game. Paula said, the choice of how you build out your character and their skills, the improvisation engine, basically... The moment-to-moment choices of how you choose to tackle a given challenge. You have a wide variety. We give you the problem, and you really choose how to solve it. We also have a faction system where there are three rival factions, and we've got our dwarves, who I'm referring to as a Deadwood meets Mensa, and our dark elves, who are the sort of intellectual Spartans, and... we have the shamblers, who are the sort of bizarre fungal hive mind. And depending on who you choose to ally with, you will have unlocked different quests, you'll have different narrative, different endings, and you'll also unlock the ability to access to exclusive weapons and runes, which tie into our procedural magic system, which it's very, very player-driven. So all these things kind of tie together in a way so that you could play through the game multiple times in potentially very, very different ways. So that's how we kind of attack that, rather than having miles and miles and miles of geo to walk through and whatnot. We really want to make it so you could play through a lot of different times and experiment and have fun.
So when you're designing the world, on a smaller scope than something like Metal Gear or The Witcher, which is, you know, like you said, this massive open world. When you're designing it to be more compact, you know, what considerations do you go through in that level design process to make it fun to traverse the same environment, you know, as the different, you know, when you're allied to different groups, like you said, or when you're playing as a different kind of type of character?
Well, it's you know, it's a matter of giving people a ton of interesting tools to work with, and even just down on the how you develop your character. Like we don't necessarily have a diehard classes. We have skills and abilities that mm-hmm. kind of fall into like combat and stealth and magic. So if you want to just bear down on any one of those areas, you could maybe develop a character that's very adaptive in a physical way if you're focusing on combat, whereas for stealth you can kind of sneak into an area, get the lay of the land, maybe sneak past an enemy. And for magic, like I said, we've got the procedural spell system, so you're kind of unlocking the source code of reality. So we basically give you all these different tools and allow you to solve things in your own way, and we also allow you to make mistakes. So I think a lot of games don't do that. I think Dark Souls does it pretty interestingly, where it's like, oh, I can kill that vendor, and now I can't get a bow to kill the dragon, mm-hmm. but I can still go through and do different things and have fun. So it's really, you may block off certain possibilities for yourself, but you're having fun, and you're experimenting, and you're having a different experience than your friends, and you chat about that. So
I thought when you said Dark Souls and mistakes, that you're just going to say the game kills you instantly.
That's not a mistake. That's intentional.
That is very
That is by design.
No, it's if when you make a mistake, roll in the wrong direction, you're going to get stabbed.
So, like, what do you... I guess, why do you think... Going back to, like, large games, why do you think that games have started getting so big, I guess? Is it just that the tools are more readily available or easier to work with nowadays, or...?
I think it's the market. I think it's really a matter of perceived value for a game. I think game companies really, they don't want you returning the game to, you know, GameStop and reselling it, and they want you having, like, well, I could be playing this game for 300 hours. I want to keep a hold of it because it's this big place. I can explore.
Right.
So, whereas in indie games, you know, you'll see a lot more, and not saying one is better than the other by any means, but in indie games you get you see people kind of bearing down on smaller areas and just really trying to refine and make the game look really, really tight.
But I think there are some trade-offs. You know, constraint is wonderful for creativity when you're constrained in some way. You think of films, and, you know, it's hard to do a film more than a couple hours. If films could be 10 hours, 50 hours for a single film that you're sitting down, I'm not sure there'd be as many good films. And so, you know, those constraints that you work with creatively help you focus on what really works well. So I think the downside to some of the really massive AAA games is the sense of, okay, we've got a team of, you know, 100 people. We're going to spend, you know, 3 or 4 years making this thing. It's going to be massive. Is that you're not forced into those decisions necessarily. And you can sort of, let's provide everything. Let's put everything in this. It doesn't necessarily make for a better game. It may be more impressive, but I'm not sure whether there's a trade-off there often.
Yeah, yeah. So let's jump ahead then to our next topic for the day, which is a similar topic, which is CRPGs. We're going to actually breeze over the Cat Fantastic quiz. I'm sorry, we lost a little too much time there. But CRPGs are these games, like you were mentioning, they're coming back to a certain extent with Divinity Original Sin and Pillars of Eternity and these amazing... For those of you who don't know the term CRPG and might be younger and not heard it, because honestly, I hadn't heard it until relatively recently, not like this month or anything, just like, you know, somewhat recently. It stands for Computer RPG, Computer Role-Playing Game, and it's basically like the classic top-down, like, adventure RPGs, right?
Well, we came up with that... The industry came up with that term because before computers, people just played Dungeons & Dragons. So those
right.
were role-playing games. And then
so you
it
had
started to,
specify. To
migrate to a computer. It's like, well, what is this thing? It's like a computer role-playing game.
It's fun to think of, you know, the time when CRPGs were the... You know, the new kid on the block versus
right.
now we're talking about CRPGs as kind of this older genre that is sort of seeing a resurgence. And you've gotten to see both ends
of
that
ends
of
it.
That
yeah.
spectrum. Yeah.
So are you, does it get you just kind of excited when you see games like Pillars of Eternity and
yes,
Divinity
it does.
Being successful?
Yeah. Yes, it does, because those were some classic games in the day, and they've come back very well, games like Wasteland and mm-hmm. 2 and Original Sin and these games. They're very well done, and I think that players are rediscovering these, and some people who never played them in the first go-around I think are enjoying them, which is cool to see.
System Shock just showed up on GOG. It's a little different than, you know, a Pillars of Eternity type
right.
game, but they finally were just able to...
The remastered version.
That was really exciting.
Yeah.
I played around with the enhanced edition a little bit and got my mouse looked working and stuff, and it looks nice. It's really cool that game is finally playable in a good mm-hmm. state for everybody. You know,
you should change it back to classic control, though.
I was messing around a little bit with the leaning and the like the three different buttons you use for going prone, crouching, standing up. I'm like, man, we have it so easy these days. You know, everything is just contextual, like one button to do stuff.
Right.
And it was much more complicated. So what have you guys played some of the recent CRPGs? You mentioned Wasteland and obviously Pillars.
Wasteland 2 mm-hmm. and Pillars, yeah. I played around with some. Again, I have so little time that when I play a game like that, it's, you know, half an hour.
They're such big investments, too, yeah. is another thing.
Yeah.
Have you gotten to play any of the more recent RPGs?
I played a bit of Shadowrun Returns and Wasteland 2. I personally am really excited about Bard's Tale 4 coming back because I played through Bard's Tale 1 through 3, and then Dragon Wars, which was it was actually kind of meant to be Bard's Tale 4 back in the day, and they didn't use a different title, so I'm pretty jazzed about that.
When I was a kid, Bard's Tale was one of the first games that I ever played with my dad, mm-hmm. And we would basically go through the character recruitment or creation at the beginning, and then go get lost and die within 10 minutes after that. You know, we'd spend an hour at the openings in the tavern and then just immediately get accosted by skeletons or brigands or something and get wiped out.
Four groups of 99 barbarians. Yeah.
We were not very good. And Bard's Tale was a little bit challenging, I think, in its day.
And so correct, was I wrong to say or to think that CRPGs are only the top-down sort of variety? Because that's kind of what I know them as. But, like, is When the term CRPG first came around, did you guys use it for, like, all types of RPGs that were just on computers? Like, whether it was first person or kind of the isometric view that I'm thinking of Wasteland and that sort of thing?
Isometric is the most common view, but
yeah.
I think Wizardry fits in the CRPG category, and that's a first person. But it's abstracted out first person.
Right.
So, you know, but most of those games were isometric or top-down.
Yeah, and those are games that, again, is similar to what we were talking about. They're very big. Like you said, they take a lot of time, Wes. Like, but also have that aspect of you could play it a million different ways and you can mm-hmm. replay it, and it'll be a very different experience if you go through as a melee character, as a caster, or what have you. And I really like seeing them kind of return because it's such a unique format for telling story in like a way that, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is it has such a lovely balance of gameplay and storytelling. Mm-hmm. Like you get these segments of gameplay and then you have like fighting or searching around a town, and even searching around a town will like progress the story as you're going through it in a mm-hmm. way that a cutscene kind of doesn't have the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that. And I really like that they're coming around. Like, it's no secret, I put like something like a little over 80 hours into Divinity Original Sin, mm-hmm. and the enhanced edition is coming out like this month, and I'm going to be putting probably another 80 hours mm-hmm. into the game. Like, and this is for someone who literally didn't grow up with the genre. Like, I grew up on Pajama Sam, as we learned on the show 2 weeks ago. Like, Pajama Sam and Putt-Putt was what I played, so it was like point and click rather than like...
How soft you were.
Yeah, I know, right? It's all about the Clue Finders series. If anybody knows what that is, but probably don't.
And I think, okay. I mean, at PC Gamer, we definitely appreciate games that are kind of, they put systems first and foremost,
mm-hmm.
and CRPGs have always balanced that with story, of course, you know,
right.
writing is really important, but I think that's something that a lot of more modern games kind of got away with for a while. They trended towards being more set piece driven and you know, telling their story through cutscenes and stuff. And it's really refreshing to play, you know, games like Pillars of Eternity where story is kind of interwoven with the systems of the game and the way your stats influence the dialogue you can use and and, you know, the options you have for progressing through the game.
There's so much I want to tell you about for that, but after we take a look at the
so we'll talk about some Underworld later.
Well, once again, we'll be getting a look at that game, Underworld Ascendant, a little bit later on. But RPGs in general, one of the things I wanted to talk about, actually, and I missed talking about it because I skipped over myself and now playing, actually, was I'd been playing WildStar a teeny tiny bit since it went free-to-play. That's the MMO that came out, I think, like a year or so ago. And,
about a year sounds right,
yeah. And then went free-to-play, like, late last week, I think it was. And I jumped in because I've always been interested in MMOs, but, like, I think I just don't have the stomach for an MMO anymore, and I think one of the reasons for it is I can play a game like Divinity, and even though that story of Divinity Original Sin is, like, kind of a melodrama about how you're, like, this god character, and it's, like, very weird that way, but, like, I can play that and be like, okay, yeah, and get into that story, but when I play WildStar, and it's like I'm being in the game at the very beginning of the game, you're getting like woken from cryostasis, right? And this voice comes to you when you're awake and it's like, you're different, like you're special. And then I load into a world with like three people that look identical to me right next to me.
Or 80 if you're playing like in launch week.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's this weird thing.
You're not quite so special.
Exactly. Yeah. Like
everyone's special.
I feel like MMOs, and this isn't, I don't mean to rag on WildStar, you know, this is like a problem that I think a lot of MMOs have. Like, they try to tell these great RPG stories, and Guild Wars 2 kind of fixed this, or, like, tried to solve this problem a little bit by making, like, your story, like, specific to you, rather than, like, you're the savior of the world. But, like, every MMO you play, I feel like the RPG and story part of it is undermined by the fact that there's 2 million people around you playing it also. I don't know.
Right. Well, imagine, like, a Conan game where you had 10,000 Conans all running around. You know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Everyone can't be the hero who changes the world in an MMO.
I guess there was that DC game that kind of did that. You would like play
DC Universe Online.
Was that the one where you played actually as a specific superhero?
I think you basically created your own superhero or villain. Okay. I think the nice thing in that is that you weren't the chosen one per se. You know, you got a chance to make a character and then interact with all the DC characters and stay away from Bizarro, you know, it was pretty neat in that regard.
And there was City of Heroes and City of Villains years before that that kind of did the same thing.
Yeah,
but it's all about the social, you know, play in the MMO.
Yeah.
So it's party play, it's with your friends, and you know, you're doing these quests, and it's not a traditional RPG in that sense, certainly.
Yeah, no, definitely, it's you play it for a different reason. Maybe
right.
You don't play it to be the savior of the universe. Right.
Play it for that loot.
Yeah.
That grind.
that ding sound every level up.
So what did you think of WildStar outside of not feeling special?
I think I didn't like it for the same reasons I don't like any MMO, which is just, like, I don't play games about grinding anymore. Like, there was another game that I can't remember what it was specifically, but I was, like, really excited for it, and then it was just kind of like a grindy RPG, and I, like, just kind of didn't have the stomach for it, you know? Like, it's not that... I think that WildStar solved some of those problems with its combat system. It was much more dynamic, you know, but you could see the UI of where you were shooting and where they were shooting at you, and it was much more engaging to actually play, but it still had that feeling of, like, go kill this many of this thing, or go to this spot and do this, and it just felt, like, I don't think I'm for MMOs anymore. I used to be. I used to like WoW a lot, but I've grown out of it. I'm an old man now.
They're not my genre either. There are a few things I don't like about them. I don't like gating the world off where, you know, you're level 15 and you like, oh, I want to go to this area where there's level 40 stuff. And, like, technically you can go there, but the way mobs are designed and stuff, you can never really experience anything. And they won't let you fight tougher enemies because they always do level scaling. And the loot grind doesn't hold much sway for me. I tried to play Final Fantasy 14 for about 2 or 3 months and leveled most of the way through the game and then realized I was not having fun at all. I just really like Final Fantasy.
If you played it for 2 or 3 months, that's longer than most.
Yeah, it was one of those games that I would play with friends, and I did enjoy spending time with them. But at some point, I realized, like, none of what we're actually doing here is entertaining me in the least. I would much rather spend this time playing something else with them, and that's what we did. So.
And that's not really to speak ill of, like, MMOs in their crap. Like, they're like, a lot of people like MMOs, clearly. Like, it's just that, you know, it doesn't sit well with some, right? But jumping to a different RPG, I want to talk about Undertale a little bit. Have you either of you guys played Undertale? Or anybody played Undertale?
Not. I've heard people talking about
it. I've only heard good things about it.
Yeah. Undertale is it's this kind of weird, Earthbound vibe-ish RPG that's
hard to describe, right?
Yeah, it is hard to describe. And it's this indie RPG that's like, I think it's like $10 on Steam. But it currently has the highest score on Metacritic of any PC game. And
of all time.
It's
beating Half-Life 2 right now.
Yeah, and for the record, just flat out, like, we are always cautious about giving Metacritic too much, like credence or power. You know, you hear these really sad stories about, like, people not getting bonuses unless their game gets an 80 on Metacritic, and it's like, I think we all at PC Gamer agree that, like, that's kind of messed up, and we don't want to, but it is also the best current score aggregator for looking at a game and how it's been getting reviewed and saying, okay, let's see what it has. And the other one is called Open Critic, the competitor that came out for Metacritic.
Just launched, yeah.
Yeah, that just launched. I think Undertale has like a 99 on that. So it's like clearly really, really high. Yeah, so just to look at the list, Undertale has a 97, Half-Life 2, Grand Theft Auto 5, Out of the Park Baseball 2007, The Orange Box, Half-Life, and Bioshock are the 96s. Hmm. So this game is currently aggregated higher than all of those, which, regardless of if Metacritic is a flawed system or not, is still incredibly impressive. Like,
and it's great that an indie studio can do that.
Yeah, it is. It is really cool. And
By the way, who else is surprised that Out of the Park Baseball 2007?
I don't think I played that one.
That must have been a great year.
Yeah.
That's like a baseball sim. That's weird.
It's got a 2.6 user rating on Metacritic, too.
Wow. But there's one review for it.
Okay, so this is what reveals this a little bit, is it's got 5 reviews on Metacritic.
Okay. So it's sort of like Yelp when you go to a little out-of-way place and it only has, you know, 2 reviews.
Yeah. And it's got 5 stars out of 5, yeah.
And it's the guy who owns the restaurant, yeah.
Well,
this is best restaurant.
Is that a factor of the Undertale? Wow, man. Is that a factor of the Undertale score that maybe the people who reviewed it are the ones who played it and, like, were like, wow, this is incredible, nobody else has played it or reviewed it, I want to get the word out, and so they gave it a 10 out of 10 score, and then suddenly it's got this crazy high review because the people that didn't care about it or hadn't heard of it because it was this indie game just didn't bother reviewing it. Like, that's got to be part of it. I'm not to belittle the game or anything. We gave it a 91.
Yeah.
Richard Cobbett gave it a 91 in an editor's choice, which for us, 91 is like, it's pretty dang high.
Richard Cobbett doesn't mess around. He doesn't give inflated scores for games. But I mean, what you mentioned is certainly a thing that people have this view of game scores often being very high, like the 70 to 100 scale or something. But part of what influences that is not every game gets reviewed. You know, not most of the games that would get a 10, you know, or a 20 because they're just non-functional, totally broken, nobody spends the time to play those very often. So most of the games that, you know, we review and that most other sites review are actually at least decent. You know, they're at least playable. So that kind of pushes stuff up some, and I'm sure fewer people have played Undertale than, you know, the latest Call of Duty.
So what's good about Undertale?
It's kind of this weird challenge of, like, what you think of as an RPG, right? So it's, like, it's, as Tyler was saying, very mean, right? Like, it would just be, like, a jerk to him, like, really, like, emotionally to him. Also, the character is, like, this very ambiguous pixel art sprite, so it's, like, not supposed to be a guy or a girl, and that's supposed to, like, you're supposed to impart your own kind of perception of it onto that character.
I think the combat system is the thing that a lot of people have really, really appreciated, and it has weird, unique combat that even I can't describe it without giving away too much of the game. But it does change in some interesting ways throughout it. And you can date a skeleton, so that's a thing.
I suppose.
That's why it's getting 10 out of 10, right?
Yeah.
It's just the skeleton dating, and that's pretty much it.
Is there going to be any skeleton dating in Underworld?
I guess now has to be, yeah. we're going to have to go further and do like lich dating or something like that. Let's get on that.
So I guess from the perspective of other side, like, how much do you guys put credence into, like, score aggregators, like Metacritic? Like, I'm imagining you guys aren't, like, basing your bonuses off of the score that Underworld will get. Like, or because you're a Kickstarter...
Bonus you give yourself.
Yeah. Because you're a Kickstarter endeavor, like, do you care less about reviewers as long as your backers are happy? Like, how do you balance that sort of thing? That attitude, I guess.
I think any game designer would like to get good reviews, but you're not ultimately doing it for the reviews. You're ultimately doing it because you have, you know, some vision and you're trying to see that vision through. And you at some level you're hoping that people will dig that, will get, you know, appreciate it. I think if you chase reviews, that seems unwise.
Mm-hmm.
Either your version is going to work and it's going to connect with people or it's not. So,
yeah.
And I think as an indie studio, and particularly the kinds of games that, you know, I've been known for, Looking Glass, we like to break some of the rules and surprise people. So who knows how people are going to review that?
Yeah.
What are some? I love some examples of that you mentioned. Sometimes
how about
a
first person game where you had to use stealth instead of, you know, guns?
yeah, where you're a vulnerable main character. Doom was the big thing at the time when Thief came out. So it was a kind of a radical thing that you had to sneak around because, man, if anybody spotted you, you were out. As opposed to, you know, running around taking out these guys.
When Thief was in development and we were working with Eidos as a publisher, there was a lot of questions about, is this really going to work? Does anyone want to play this game? This doesn't really make a lot of sense. Why, you can't just run up and, you know, behead somebody? and there was a lot of questioning. And, you know, we had to stick with our conviction that, well, we don't know if there's going to be a big market for this, but it's different and we want to try it out.
Were you sweating it a little bit?
A little bit, yes.
The final AI for it came together really pretty late in the project.
Yes,
so
yes. There were challenges of that sort. But even the trying to technically get it done, there was just a question of, do people want to play a stealthy first-person game? Because that hadn't been done before, and it wasn't clear that that was going to work. And people, it was so ingrained in a first-person shooter, you know, the run and gun, and you're strafing, and, you know, you're just basically a big machine gun on wheels. In these games of that era. Still today, that's true a lot of first-person games. So it's a very different approach.
When you make a game like Thief that kind of, you know, defies convention and then it's successful and you find out, oh, people do actually want to play this, and then you make a sequel like Thief 2 or Underworld 2, you know, what do you do then to try to... Then you're working within this new convention you've established. So then what do you do to push that forward into, you know, challenging what people expect at that point?
Well, it's interesting you asked, because both Underworld 2 and Thief 2 shared a commonality that those were sort of relatively quickly done sequels to the original games. And in both of those cases, our target for what we really wanted to do creatively in pushing it forward was Underworld 3 and Thief 3. And we didn't get to do either. So we didn't really fulfill that, but we wanted to go deeper with it. Once we saw that stealth could work, it was, well, now where can we take this? Where can we go with this? And I think with Underworld Ascendant, it's really our, you know, 20 years later, it's an opportunity to actually take that forward.
Cool. Yeah, for the Ultima Underworld 1 and 2 were games that really pioneered systemic gameplay, the sort of emergent gameplay that you see in a lot of games, you know, since games that are like, you know, the Deus Ex series and whatnot that were very inspired by that series. And but there are still aspects of that haven't been capitalized upon. So one of the things we're trying to do with Underworld Ascendant is really take that sort of emergent gameplay to the next level. So we'll get a chance to show you how.
I feel like we should move in that direction. So we
can talk about the world. Let's actually do that right before the Twitch chat Q&A. We're going to be showing you, this is one of the first looks at the current gameplay of Underworld Ascendant, which is Other Side Entertainment's.
And this is very, very early. This is, again, our first playable that we're showing. And this is just showing you one kind of encounter. In this case, you're a female rogue character with a little bit of magic skills. And you've dropped into a dwarven area. They're great works.
And this is definitely a far cry from what we saw in your Kickstarter video, which you guys said was very, very much like placeholder prototype.
Hopefully people see the visuals have come a long way.
Yeah, definitely.
We're really pushing the engine very hard. We've shifted to Unity 5 on this and doing a lot with graphics.
Is that a lava tree?
Lava vortex, technically speaking.
The dwarves have taken this artifact, which is kind of the heart of a fire elemental over here, and are using it to redirect lava up into these vents up in the ceiling, and it's powering their machinery. It's being used for epic purposes and mundane purposes and everything.
And the thief doesn't really care about that. She just wants the valuable artifact.
So is this like a mission? Essentially, like you're in, this is what a mission would
this
be.
This would
right?
be
like
an example of.
Or our quest.
A quest where the thief says, hey, you know, someone says, if you can steal that artifact, it's worth a lot. Of course, she's kind of wrecking the dwarven works, but she doesn't care. She's just,
A peek at the improvisation engine through the lens of one character, and this character is basically unarmed except for a few spells, and is having to really think on her feet and utilize the environment to survive against, well, I'll let you see.
She grabs the artifact.
No problem.
Somebody objects. This is the Shadow Beast, which was a character we had, or a monster we had in the original Underworlds. Rendered a little bit different.
Right. And do you guys try to bring a lot of that, the old kind of Underworld assets, assets, but like
we
monsters
have
and
some
that sort of
characters
things.
And monsters and settings.
Familiar faces.
Yep.
There's narrative hooks into the first two games. And,
So here she has the artifact, which allows her to now control the lava flow herself. So she's going to use the lava, the heat, and the light to try to keep the pursuing Shadow Beast off her tail.
Yeah, the Shadow Beast is a kind of a peek at what we're calling our strategic ecology. And what that is, it's something Paul's pushed us on. The original Looking Glass games had, they have very pioneering systemic gameplay. Sometimes you had to dig in a little bit and really find how those systems worked. In this, all of our creatures are going to have these readily observable traits, strengths and weaknesses, wants and desires. In this case, the Shadow Beast is near invisible in a low light situation, but he always casts a shadow. He hates light. He'll destroy torches, try to put things out. And he's also very sensitive to high levels of light. So you can kind of observe these things and really try to formulate strategies around them.
This is really a flip of thief in a way, because the creature is using stealth against you as a player.
Uh-huh.
You're trying to create light sources.
He just went invisible.
He just went invisible, but he's going to like extinguish that light behind you. So he's using thief-like tactics against you as a player.
Hmm.
And you're trying to counter.
And you said this is just one kind of class, right? Or like this is one play style of approaching
right.
the shadows.
Right. So if you happen to be a really strong fighter, you might have just at the beginning just taken it on head to head and killed it and not gone through all of this.
And this is also an example of your player choice, is that this is a rogue character who has a few spells, and you may decide by looking at like, hey, I really like magic, I really like playing around with this procedural spell system, but I'd like to sneak in and get the lay of the land and see what sort of spells I should prepare for, so I'm going to do some stealth abilities as well. So you can really mix and match and make it your own play style.
That's right.
I have to say I was just watching some Ultima Underworld yesterday from a playthrough, and for some reason, even knowing you guys were working in Unity 5 and that it's not 1991 anymore, I wasn't quite prepared for it being this much more atmospheric than the original game.
Yeah, this is still not the final look of the game. We're still, but it's a, you know,
the first beginning. We'll may continue to make visual improvements and such.
So what just happened there with the shadow beast?
With the light gets to a certain level of intensity, the heat and the light, the shadow beast just spontaneously combusts. Mm-hmm.
You just blew him up.
Has to get to a very high level, though, so it's difficult. You need all this lava.
A lot of lava. A lot of lava. The lava vortex looked really cool.
Yeah, it's kind cool of... element. We wanted to show... So this is just a very small corner of the abyss, but we wanted to show a signature space. And obviously the abyss, as in the originals, is set in an active volcano. So having one of the lava events, that lava event was 3 kilometers across, so it's a huge lava event. We just wanted to show that as a piece of it, so it doesn't look like a generic dungeon.
Yeah. Our dwarves are, you get a little hint at their, as Paul said, the great work. Our dwarves are a little different than in other fantasy games and novels and movies. We're really trying to take this mantra of a fantasy evolved to heart, and they may be taller than the definition of a dwarf. They may have evolved a little taller than that, but they're like the only race within the Stygian Abyss that is there intentionally. They actually want to be there, which is crazy. It's a really, really harsh place to be, but they're there. They have this philosophy that is they see nature as this brutal force that has to be tamed, and to actually stop a volcano from erupting, something we haven't even done in real life, is if they can do that, they can do anything. So it's kind of, I've been likening it to if NASA putting a man on the moon was something that they did on their own steam. It was a multi-generational effort and done entirely just to prove a philosophical point. So they're very driven. So.
And we can start taking questions from our Twitch, to start up our Twitch chat Q&A as we continue talking about the game. So if you have any questions for us, type into the chat with just tagging us at PC Gamer, and we'll grab them. If you have any questions for Paul or Joe, I'm sure they'd be happy to answer as well. I saw a lot of "this is beautiful" sort of stuff and "good job" and that sort of thing. So it does really look nice.
I want to go back to a question I asked earlier about level design. Now that we've seen, you know, a little chunk of the abyss, I'm curious how you design a setting like the abyss that's kind of by definition this dank, you know, underground area to have interesting landmarks or to be fun to traverse, you know, when you're going through corridors and caves and stuff. And, you know, what's kind of your design philosophy to make that a fun space?
Well, so the original, you know, Underworld and Underworld 2, there were sections that were sort of a dank abyss, dark, and sort of, you know, what you might expect. But there were also a lot of locations that were just crazy, you know, fantasy. So it is a high fantasy setting. And there's a lot of magic and a lot of sort of, you know, different kind of spaces that don't look like a dungeon in any way. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's probably more spaces that don't look like a traditional dungeon than there are that look like a traditional dungeon. We want a nice palette, a creative palette that we can work with. And we have the three factions are one way we can do that because, you know, the dwarves will have, a typical look of whether they construct spaces. And then the dark elves have a very different aesthetic that they go after. And the shamblers, yet again. That gives us sort of three baselines, a very different feeling and looking spaces within the abyss.
You'll continue, please.
It's also a kind of an accidental ecology. Life isn't actually supposed to exist here in the Stygian Abyss. It's a very a brutal place, but we have these rune gates that have brought in atmosphere and creatures from other places. And so these things have kind of formed unnaturally. Snow might have come in from an ice world and whatnot. And so you see life kind of finding its way throughout there. It gives us a chance to do a lot of strange, improbable, fun things with that space.
Tyler1118 asks, can the game be viewed in third person as well, or is it just first person?
You know, it's a good question. We've kind of strongly leaned to purely first person because that's just the aesthetic. And again, it's a constraint, and constraint often can help with creativity. As soon as you say, well, you can also do it in third person, you start making compromises often on the design. So our intent is to keep it entirely first person.
Cool. And then Workster asks, can you describe how the faction system works a little more? So you align yourself with one of these groups at the beginning of the game, or is that like when you choose your race, you're immediately aligned?
That's a little farther into the game. It takes a while before you actually get to meet them and get a sense of the different factions and what they're about and what how they're kind of they're not warring, they're definitely butting heads, and so
different philosophies, different life philosophies.
But
you start, I mean, like the original Underworld, you start as an avatar. You're human from today, and you go through a rune gate, and you find yourself as a stranger in a strange land in the abyss. And the early arc is you're just trying to survive in this bizarre place, and what are these monsters attacking you? It's not till somewhat later that you start to learn that there's other intelligent beings who've kind of made a home for themselves, and then you know. You do ultimately have decisions about who you're going to support.
Can you join a faction and betray that faction and join a?
It's a great question. Something we've debated. We've talked about the Yojimbo scenario where you play them off each other.
Yojimboing has become a verb. Yeah.
Or the fistful of dollars scenario for some other people.
Red Harvest. Yeah.
Oh, I love Red Harvest. It's a great book. The original. So you're still thinking about that?
Yeah.
It hasn't been decided. We got more than a year to go, so we have to make some decisions.
Our latest sub, who subbed during all the technical difficulties, so you know he or she is a true fan, 12GTCom asks, what coming soon games are you all most hyped for? Because November coming up is a big month for games, and this month we've got some good ones too. I'm going to go ahead and just start off by saying I'm just excited for the Divinity Original Sin Enhanced Edition. I think, like, I'm excited for Fallout 4, but at the same time, I think I'm going to be giving my time to Divinity, honestly. Obviously, you guys are working on your own game, and I think that's still a little off to be considered coming soon, but is there anything you're looking forward to maybe in the coming month?
Fallout 4, you mentioned that definitely. It's set in Boston, so it's, you know, like, we'll be able to, hopefully they'll give us a tactical advantage, you know, going through Quincy and whatnot. Beyond that, geez, definitely looking forward to the Bard's Tale 4, like I mentioned before, and the DLC for Witcher 3. Really looking forward to that.
That's quite soon. That's like this weekend.
Maybe this week.
Very soon. What about you, Wes?
Fallout 4 is definitely on there. Hyperlight Drifter. I'm not sure if they're making it out this year or not, but
yeah,
I'm still
that's pretty cool.
Really excited about that game. Paul, are you going to allow yourself to play anything?
I'll play some Fallout 4. I was a big Fallout fan. Dishonored 2, but I'm not sure when that's coming out sometime.
Yeah, I guess next year probably.
Next year,
when is No Man's Sky?
Haven't said.
They were just
on the Colbert Report, the Colbert Late Night with Stephen Colbert last week, and did not give the date out, so it's still playing it close to the chest.
Somebody actually in our comments had a really interesting on PCGamer.com had a really interesting observation about that they seem to be bringing like the same anything can happen procedural demo to basically every time they've shown the game over the last like at least 6 months, at least since E3, right? And it's kind of funny because the game is all about like every time you play it's different, anything can happen, and since they're bringing the same demo, like the same basic like demo slice every time, it makes the game kind of feel like in my mind like very similar every time I see it looks like the same things are happening, even though fundamentally what their game is about and what they're trying to show off is that every time it's different. So it's almost like I feel like they just need to to tell us when it's coming out at this point. Like, I know that obviously it's hard to commit to that sort of thing, but I just want to know, man. Like,
it'll be when it's done, hopefully.
And
not before.
That is the main hope.
That actually, I think, is a good leads to a good question for you guys. Is like, game fans most of the time want to play the game as soon as it's possibly ready. Some people are fine with delays because they'd rather see, you know, a polished game or whatever. But you were talking about working within constraints, and I know for a game to ship, inevitably you have to cut features. You have to make hard decisions. Can you talk a little bit about that creative process?
Well, one advantage we have over when we're doing the original Underworlds is we're going to do digital distribution. And so you can release a game and then do, you know, DLCs and much more readily do expansions. You know, you're not locked into a retail kind of a cycle.
And patches.
and patches. And so, yeah, I mean, we're going to try to, you know, stay on our schedule and deliver it. And that does force you to creatively decide, well, what's most important? What's the most important experiences here? And kind of keep it a little leaner. But then you can expand it from there and you can continue to build on it. So it's not, you know, these things now have lives that go well beyond their, you know, initial commercial release. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, if treated well, done well.
Jeffer the Frog asks a good question of, will there be as much emphasis on sound and music as Thief 1 and 2 had? And will Eric Brosius input into this aspect of development?
So probably yes is the answer to that. I mean, it's not going to use sound quite in the same way that Thief... Sound and Thief was just absolutely essential to
right.
the gameplay because it was all about stealth.
Which we talked about a bit earlier.
And this isn't yeah. all about stealth. So from that standpoint, it's not so heavily... or gameplay doesn't revolve so heavily around sound, but we've got some in this demo has some awesome sound in it. We've got a full yeah. sound environment and ambience, and you will use sound to play. I mean, you'll hear things around you. One of the things we want to keep visibility. The demo doesn't show this. Prototype doesn't show this so well, but typically your view radius will be somewhat limited. It'll be somewhat claustrophobic. We're trying to get, it's a more intimate view. Mm-hmm. It's not like a Skyrim you can see for miles and miles, and so. In a dungeon crawl kind of context, there's a lot outside your view radius, and you'll hear it, monsters, before you see them, typically.
Yeah.
And sort of wondering what's around the corner, is there's a lot of fun tension there to be played. But then the audio has to support that.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a lot of fun with the sound design for it. Even with the Shadow Beast, you know, we definitely wanted to key off of Scary Monster in the Dark. Some of the Shadow Beast growls are... inspired by the sort of a low growl that an alligator will do when it makes the water, you know, dance on its back. It's a sort of mating call, and it's just a very, like, unnerving sound to hear from something that's sneaking up on you in the dark. So
I'm really glad I've never heard that sound in person
before. Yeah. Well, we don't have Eric Brosius. He's at Harmonix. But Terry Brosius is actually going to do some voice acting for us.
She
was the voice of Shodan.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And that's exciting.
Stephen Russell from
Russell.
Original Thief series.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, I think that's all the time we have for questions today. Thank you very much to Joe Fielder and Paul Neuwirth for joining us today on the show. Once again, to everybody at home and to you guys as well, sorry about all the delays and the problems, but I think we hit a lot of really cool things, and thank you for bringing Underworld Ascendant to show off for us. More on that. Do we have a website or something you can pitch for that? A shout out to
underworldascendant.com.
There you go.
And follow us on Twitter at @otherside_games.
There you go. There. So if you want to learn more about Underworld Ascendant or see that video again or in the future, underworldascendant.com. I've been Tom Marks, assistant editor here at PC Gamer. Thank you very much for joining me. Also with Wes Fenlon, our hardware editor. I mentioned you first. At the beginning of the show, so I'm mentioning you last now. But
fair enough.
Thanks very much, everyone. We will be back again next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific time. Hopefully this time without as many delays or bumps in the road, but we once again appreciate you sticking with us on that one. So we'll see you then, and thanks again.